From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Social critic Barbara Ehrenreich suggests that the middle class became more selfish in the 1980s. On today's Fresh Air, Ehrenreich analyzes recent shifts in the attitude of the middle class. Also today, the further adventures of lesbian feminist detective Emma Victor. We talk with Victor's creator, mystery writer Mary Wings. Jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews Spy vs. Spy, John Zorn's interpretations of Ornette Coleman compositions. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new thriller Sea of Love, starring Al Pacino and Ellen Barkin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. A House subcommittee was stood up today by the former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Sam Pierce, who canceled his appearance at the last minute, saying he needed more time to prepare. The committee now plans to subpoena Pierce, as NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The subcommittee had planned to question Pierce about mismanagement and fraud that occurred at HUD when he ran the agency. Last week, Pierce's attorneys asked for a 2-week delay in his testimony so that they could wade through the huge pile of documents they've requested from HUD. The committee refused. Then, late yesterday afternoon, Pierce sent a letter to the chairman of the committee, Tom Lantos, telling him he would not show up this morning. But he repeated his intention to testify voluntarily sometime in the near future. Lantos accused Pierce of breaking faith with the committee, and he began the process to compel Pierce to testify. However, by the time the committee meets again, votes to subpoena Pierce, and then schedules a new hearing, Pierce will end up with the 2-week delay he asked for. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In the aftermath of yesterday's massacre in Louisville, Kentucky, President Bush remains opposed to restrictions on automatic weapons. Rich James reports.
President Bush says he feels terrible that 7 people were killed and more than a dozen injured at the hands of a Louisville man armed with an assault weapon. But the president says this does not convince him that a federal law banning these guns is necessary.
The loss of human life is horrible, but I have seen no evidence that a law banning a specific weapon is going to guard against it.
Bush, a member of the National Rifle Association, says more should be done to enforce the gun laws already on the books. To date, the administration has banned the import of automatic and semi-automatic weapons, such as the AK-47 used yesterday in Louisville. But he has so far refused to restrict domestic production of these same guns. For National Public Radio, I'm Rich James in Washington.
Exxon today ended cleanup operations in Alaska, undertaken after the spill of the Exxon Valdez. Exxon officials pronounced the 1,100 miles of oily shoreline environmentally stable. While state officials agreed some shorelines were cleaner because of Exxon's efforts, they disputed the company's rosy portrayal of an environmental rebound from nearly 11 million gallons of spilled crude. The government reported today wholesale prices declined for the third straight month in August as a big drop in energy costs helped keep inflation in check. The Labor Department said its producer price index fell 0.4%, matching the decline in July. It is the first time wholesale prices have fallen 3 consecutive months since a 4-month drop January through April of 86. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 9 points to close at 2674.58. This is NPR News. Senate discussions began today on adding more than $2 billion to President Bush's war on drugs, with Democrats and Republicans promising to work together to resolve the dispute. But at least 2 Republicans who attended a meeting today accused the Democrats of playing politics with the drug issue and urged them to support the president's plan. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden said the Democrats would offer a long-term drug plan within a few months. He said one of its goals would be to provide treatment for all drug users who want help. While the president announced an increase in U.S. food aid to Poland, Western nations are being criticized for not fulfilling promises of aid for Eastern European nations, which are undergoing political reforms. The BBC's Jack Thompson reports.
One critic of the West's performance has been Mr. Frans Andriessen, the vice president of the European Commission, who's in charge of organizing emergency aid for Poland and Hungary. He said despite announcing a concerted aid package for the two countries in July, member states of the European community didn't seem to have the political will to make this a reality. At the beginning of last month, the community said it would ship $120 million worth of food to Poland. President Jaruzelski has said that Poland needs more than that, as much as 700,000 tons of food before the end of the year, and nearly another 4 million tons in the next 2 years. Some European Community officials say the big problem is storing and distributing the food in Poland itself. The recent political changes in Warsaw have meant that no one there wants to take on the responsibility for this.
The BBC's Jack Thompson in London. A senior Hungarian official said today Hungary is allowing East Germans to flee the West because it values democratic reforms more than East Bloc unity. East Germany's leadership has angrily rejected calls for similar reforms. Officials in Budapest also said the Soviet Union has not exerted any pressure on Hungary. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Social critic Barbara Ehrenreich says a change came over the middle class professionals, in the 1980s. They retreated from liberalism to a meaner, more selfish outlook, hostile to those with less clout and less money. Her new book, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, analyzes how and why the middle class changed between the 60s and the 80s. Ehrenreich is a columnist for Ms. Magazine and Mother Jones. She's also written books about the sexual revolution's impact on women, men's revolt against the breadwinner ethic, and the financial vulnerability of women. Ehrenreich's premise in Fear of Falling is that partly in reaction to the revolts of the 60s, the middle class has become increasingly insular and self-absorbed and anxious to distance itself from the working class and the poor. I asked her what evidence she could cite to support this.
Partly I'm just following through the ideas of what you could call the intellectual elite of the middle class, the professional middle class, and seeing how those ideas changed from a time in the 60s when it was, you might say, fashionable to be a liberal to the 80s when it has become equally fashionable to be a conservative. So it's partly just tracking those ideas. But it's also looking at, I don't know how to describe it, except sort of the mood of the professional middle class from something that you could sense in the media, in popular culture, in all sorts of forms in the 60s as pretty optimistic, expansive, feeling that we really could solve problems like poverty, to a mood in the 80s which seems much more self-centered, withdrawn, pessimistic.
Now, you're looking at a specific part of the middle class. You're looking at what you call the professional middle class. Who are they?
Well, the professional middle class is it's doctors, lawyers, it's professionals, it's social workers, it's professors. It's something we intuitively understand. I mean, we go around saying middle class, which means almost nothing these days, but intuitively we know there's a difference within it. We distinguish between the professional middle class, and the working class, which can be blue collar, pink collar, even white collar these days. So, you know, I think it's not an unfamiliar kind of distinction to make. And I was interested in the professional middle class because this is the group that contains our opinion makers. This is where the journalists are, the pundits, the commentators, the professors, the so-called experts on a range of subject. These are the people who really have an enormous influence over how we think about ourselves as a people, and yet nobody really thinks too much about them as a group. So I think that's something novel about this book.
Mm-hmm. You think that the professional middle class has had an increasing urge to distinguish itself from the rest of the middle class. Examples?
Well, there's always been this urge. I mean, the professional middle class is a very anxious class. It's not at the top. It's not the upper class. So there's always this need to distinguish itself from people lower down, and that means all sorts of little cues, little things you do to signal that you're in a professional middle class. Today, that might mean things about how you dress. It might mean natural fibers instead of synthetics. It will definitely mean a lot about what you eat. I mean, this is, when I say you, I mean if you're so inclined to send out these signals. Do you eat, I don't really know what is the most fashionable thing to eat right now, but perhaps, you know, it used to be sushi. Do you eat that or do you eat cheeseburgers? There are just all sorts of ways that we, without even thinking about it, check off what kind of class a person is in.
Yeah, well, you point out department stores, for instance, that do you shop at Penny's or Bloomingdale's, and how few department stores there are now that cater to both classes, both the working class and the middle class.
Yeah, because of this widening split, which is part of a very disturbing, I think, overall trend in our society toward becoming more polarized, more unequal, just in terms of class. It's been written about often enough now that I think most people know that the rich have been getting richer, the poor have been getting poorer. This is since the 70s, and more numerous, and then the middle class is being sort of stretched and pulled apart.
How so?
As the professional middle class does fairly well, and as the blue-collar and pink-collar working class actually loses ground due to deindustrialization, losses of, you know, the old decent-paying unionized jobs, the gap is widening.
Social critic Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest. We're talking about her new book, which is called Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. You say that the middle class came to see itself as an elite, whereas it used to see itself as the universal class, the typical American. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
Well, in the 50s, the myth about America, and I should say the professional middle class myth about America, was that everybody was middle class, that there were no more classes in American society. It's sort of fun, in a funny way, to read what people said at that time. And I'm talking about very well-known and respected intellectuals who really said, no more problems in America because we've just become totally equal. Nothing left to do. Well, then, of course, they discovered poverty and there was something left to do. But over, you know, as the years passed, this sense that we were just all one big middle class, which was never true, began to erode. And I found, and I was sort of surprised to find this, that a crucial turning point for the intellectual elite of the middle class was the student movement and the youth movement of the 60s, which seemed to a lot of well-known respected professors and intellectuals to be a real attack on their own values. It was an attack not just against the war and things like that, but it was really an attack on hierarchy, on the idea that some people should naturally assume a higher status and command over other people. That was very threatening. Then you begin to see a real right turn. That's when the neoconservatives really emerge or begin to think in a neoconservative way.
What is the fear of falling that you identify with the professional middle class? You've titled your book Fear of Falling.
Well, there are two fears here. One is the straightforward fear of just losing your income and position and, being wiped out in some way and sliding down economically. The other, which I have never found any, you know, real discussion of anywhere else, is something more subtle, perhaps not entirely rational at all. And it has to do with the peculiar features of the professional middle class. If you're rich, in contrast, you know your children can be rich just by leaving them your money. But if you're in the professional middle class, you know your children are going to have to go through that whole long process of education and credentialing that you went through in order to become a member of the same class. So there's a lot of anxiety about being tough enough, a fear of going soft. I mean, people in the middle class, like everywhere else, want affluence. They want things, but they're frightened of it at the same time, afraid that they'll surrender to, as they often put it in writings, hedonism, self-indulgence, and then just won't have what it takes anymore.
Do you think that has to do with the obsessive working hours that so many people are putting in now, and the even obsessions with staying hard physically?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, in the late 50s and early 60s, dieting was very much a professional middle class preoccupation. Now, actually, that's disseminated to just, you know, everybody. But you could interpret that as a way of saying, yes, we have all this affluence, we have all these good things, but we're still strong enough to resist it. We still have some willpower. In the 80s, we've shifted to fitness, which is, of course, great. It's great to be fit. But there's another level of interpretation that I think it's a way of working off guilt and anxiety about consumption. I mean, this has been a decade of economists call a consumer binge among those who could afford to binge. And fitness, I think, is one way in which we say, hey, look, we're still hard. Yes, we're eating up all that creme fraiche and stuff all the time, but look how tough we are.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the middle class, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is social critic Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book is called Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest. Do you think that the guilt and anxiety that you were just discussing in relationship to the fear of falling, do you think that guilt and anxiety are being experienced any differently now by the professional middle class than, say, it was being experienced in the 1960s by the middle class?
I think that underlying theme is there, that fear of going soft, that remains true. I think it takes different expressions. I think in the 80s and, well, in the 70s and the 80s, one of the ways that was expressed, particularly by conservative figures, intellectuals and political figures, was a fear of permissiveness, charge that American society had become permissive at all levels, sexually, judicially, in terms of welfare and everything. And this is another way of saying, well, we're getting soft. I should just say, you know, for a reality check, that we are not a permissive society, certainly not in terms of how we treat criminals. We're one of the harshest societies in the world in that respect. We're certainly not a permissive society in how we treat the poor. We have the most miserly welfare programs of any comparable advanced country. But this is that old anxiety that we're just never somehow tough enough.
You know, getting back to the idea of fear of falling, there are a lot of rational reasons to fear falling out of the middle class right now. A lot of the people who you'd call the professional middle class, the opinion makers and so on, are funded by grants and nonprofit organizations, or they're working at organizations that might go under any minute, or they're university professors making, you know, a decent but, you know, hardly exceptional salary. And if they're not tenured, you know, they can be out real quick. So there really is that possibility of losing your job, losing your income, and okay, probably you'd find another job, but I think there is this really real feeling of a lack of security, even among many in the professional middle class.
Oh, I think absolutely, and even people with very secure jobs and two nice fat incomes coming in have to face escalating housing costs and then a cost which is, you know, cuts at the very heart of the assumptions of the professional middle class. College tuition has just, you know, gone out of sight. So there are real reasons for anxiety now, real reasons to sort of speed up, to hustle ever harder, I think. At some point, I think we're going to have to stop, though, and say, is there a better way to do it? Are we going to have to look to take some sort of political action to contain these costs or guarantee access to higher education so it's not so demanding?
I guess one of the questions you're trying to ask here is this fear of falling, this anxiety about not having enough money or possibly losing one's job or, you know, so on. Is that creating a movement for social change, or is it creating an embattled mentality that is trying to create more fortresses around the professional middle class?
Well, sadly, I think it's mostly creating an embattled mentality right now, because when the professional middle class looks out at other people, and of course I'm generalizing here, but I'm talking about things in our imagery, in our media, and even college textbooks, it does not see a very good image of other Americans. The professional middle class has very demeaning stereotypes of the American majority. The typical, the stereotype of the blue-collar worker is still the Archie Bunker stereotype, the idea that they are, you know, dumb, bigoted, reactionary, inarticulate, backward, etc. Now, if that's what you think of so many Americans, you're not going to really find allies in terms of dealing with your problems. By the way, another little reality check. Actually, it is the working class that tends to be more liberal on all kinds of issues, certainly economic issues, and in terms of party affiliation. That stereotype is dead wrong, but we tend to cling to it.
Can you give us an example that would challenge the stereotype?
Well, in terms of how you vote, the working class tends to be more democratic. I mean, in fact, this is, in recent years, the sort of polarization, political polarization between the classes has grown. Even in some social issues, like approval of the women's movement, if anything, there is a slightly greater level of support and approval as you go down the income levels. So that's really an outmode. It was probably never a viable or a very accurate stereotype. But I think that it reinforces the fortress mentality of the professional middle class, that there's nobody out there. Then the stereotype of the poor is, if anything, even more degrading, that they're promiscuous and lazy and can't wind an alarm clock and get up in the morning, no point in helping them, etc. If that's how you look at the poor, then they, too, cannot be allies for change.
Social critic Barbara Ehrenreich is my guest. Her new book is about the middle class. It's called Fear of Falling. When I ask you, Barbara Ehrenreich, what class are you in? What are you going to say?
Well, I'm trying to hold on to a position in the professional middle class, unless I get dragged down by college tuitions for my children. I'm expecting to end up as a bag lady in a few years.
Do you really worry, though, about not being able to send your children to college?
Oh, well, I'm doing it, but, you know, I'm experiencing some of these kinds of anxieties. It's very hard. When, you know, you face college costs now that seem to be set at a level that would be comfortable for the ultra-rich. I can't imagine how else they're set, because obviously there are some people who are not offended by a bill for $20,000 a year. Obviously there are some people who are not offended by having to pay thousands of dollars a month for a little bit of urban space to live in. See, the very wealthy have bid up the costs of things that are sort of traditional middle-class things to want or need.
What class did you come from?
Well, I was born in the blue-collar working class, and I guess the one reason why I was sensitive to stereotypes was because I am an immigrant from that class, you might say. And as I encountered stereotypes and prejudice, I should say there's also prejudice. I knew what quote, these people, as they're often called, are like. I knew they weren't dumb and inarticulate. I knew they were often brilliant and funny and smart and ambitious, and I certainly knew they weren't reactionary. Where I came from in Butte, Montana, copper mining town, extremely liberal, and left-wing town, with a history of militant strikes. So I had something to carry around with me to test some of these stereotypes against.
What did your parents do?
My father was a copper miner, and my mother was originally a homemaker.
Mm-hmm. Did they hope that you would get out of the working class into the middle class? Was that an aspiration?
Oh, yes. In fact, my father did himself. You know, he got an education and eventually ended up in a comfortable white-collar job. But, yes, that was the aspiration in our family, partly for the very good reason that many people didn't live long when they were minors. Still true. Most dangerous occupation. People want to get out of it. And the professional middle class is not a bad place to be in. If you're in a professional occupation, you have a lot more control over your life and your day-to-day work than, say, a factory worker or a lower-level hospital worker or something. You set the pace. You often tell other people what to do or, you know, come up with the ideas that will determine what they'll do. So, yeah, we all want to be in the professional middle class, I think.
You say when you were growing up that you knew the stereotypes of the working class were inaccurate. What were the images that affected you most on television or in movies, in magazines?
Well, as I mentioned, there's the Archie Bunker image. I don't think we've come a long way with Roseanne, which, you know, it has its endearing side, but I think that's very stereotyped. You know, here we have the working class and they're overweight and their preoccupations sometimes seem intensely trivial. And another program would be Married with Children, which I found very offensive, but not for the same reason that woman did who started the drive to cut its sponsorship. I found it offensive because of its stereotype of working class, lower middle class people.
It's a tricky thing with Roseanne, you know. You criticize it because, well, the working class, hey, they're fat. On the other hand, hey, what a victory. People who are heavy are getting leads on TV. How unusual, especially in the 80s.
I know, but I'm just saying, yeah, sure, there are fat people in every class, and I would like to see them respected with positive imagery in the mm-hmm. media, too. But I think it goes along with that professional middle class notion that the working class, they drink a lot of beer, they're sort of slobs. And this is hurtful stuff. This is, as well as being untrue, it's a way of just closing yourself off to the real diversity of America. I think the professional middle class is very insular. People within it, will marry other members of the class, and that's more and more so true since the 80s. And the pressure to make a lot of money. You want to marry a social equal in that class. Doctors don't marry their nurses. Doctors marry doctors and so forth. People in this class associate socially with other members of their class. There is just a huge gap of knowledge. And ironically, the poor and the working class know more about the professional middle class than vice versa. Because if you turn on TV, you will see in great detail the anxieties and the loves and the concerns and so on and the faces of professional middle-class people. You will not see realistic depictions of everyone else.
The kind of materialism and self-absorption that you've been describing has really been, in a way, seen as a phenomenon of the 80s. And it's 1989 now, or it's the end of the decade. Do you see this trend ending?
Well, you can't say for sure, but I think something is happening. I think that a kind of revulsion is setting in against this frenetic materialism. And one form it's been taking is, I think, a certain disgust with the behavior of some of the ultra-rich. I mean, we hear a lot about the underclass. I think there should be more talk about the bloated overclass. Malcolm Forbes with his $2 million birthday party. Leona Helmsley with her amazing contempt for the rest of us, Donald Trump, the whole lot of them. I think that's causing some kind of reevaluation. Is that what it all leads to if you are successful?
Okay, well, Barbara Ehrenreich, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been writer and social critic Barbara Ehrenreich. Her new book, Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class, is published by Pantheon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, screenwriter and film director Paul Schrader. He wrote the screenplays for Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ, and he directed Light of Day, Hardcore, Mishima, and Patty Hearst. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Emma Victor is an amateur detective and a lesbian feminist. The crimes she solves require an understanding of the criminal mind and a familiarity with nonprofit women's organizations and women's bars. Coming up, we meet her creator, mystery writer Mary Wings. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Spy vs. Spy, featuring John Zorn playing Ornette Coleman compositions. Kevin detects the influence of hardcore punk. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Sea of Love, starring Al Pacino as a cop looking for a serial killer and Ellen Barkin as his sultry lover and prime suspect. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Thousands of people took part in an anti-apartheid march in Johannesburg today, taking advantage of the recent easing of attitudes toward peaceful demonstrations. Mike Wooldridge of the BBC was there.
The marchers assembled at Johannesburg's Anglican Cathedral, where the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches said the newly re-elected National Party government under Mr. S.W. de Klerk was declaring itself ready for change, and if this was the case, it had to address itself to the demands of the majority of South Africa's people.
We want freedom of assembly. We want freedom to choose our government.
From the cathedral, the march wound its way through central Johannesburg. Several uninvited and unmarked police cars led the way, the plainclothes policemen inside videoing and taking photographs of the growing crowd. The marchers displayed ANC and other banned flags. In a smaller protest, but one of no less significance, several hundred people congregated in a square in South Africa's capital, Pretoria, to demonstrate against apartheid.
Mike Wooldridge of the BBC. A meeting is slated next month between the government of El Salvador and leftist rebel leaders to talk about a ceasefire in the 10-year-old war in that country. The fighting has claimed 70,000 lives. A joint statement issued today in Mexico City after 3 days of talks between the two sides says the next meeting will be October 16th and 17th and will be followed by monthly talks aimed at ending the conflict in the shortest time possible. After a trial run on Capitol Hill, the Bush administration is giving up its idea of channeling millions of U.S. dollars to a presidential candidate in Nicaragua. Administration officials say that they have concluded that the plan would go beyond the charter of the National Endowment for Democracy. Barry Schweid reports from the State Department.
The idea was to use the National Endowment, which Congress set up for such purposes as poll watching. The group has been used for such purposes in Panama, Chile, and elsewhere. But when Secretary of State James Baker went to Capitol Hill this week to see about channeling funds to Violeta Chamorro through the National Endowment, Democrats and Republicans alike were against the idea. Chamorro, the publisher of La Prensa, is running against President Daniel Ortega next February. The Bush administration wants very much for her to win over the Sandinista president. But the State Department says other ways to help Chamorro will have to be found, such as persuading private groups to contribute to her campaign. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The condition of Mother Teresa has improved slightly, but doctors in Calcutta say that she is still seriously ill. The Nobel Prize winner has been hospitalized for a week with heart problems. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 5 points to close at 2,670.02 on volume of some 236 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Composer and saxophonist John Zorn is known for his musical unpredictability. He's paid tribute to detective writer Mickey Spillane, soundtrack composer Ennio Morricone, and hard bop jazzmen Hank Mobley and Sonny Clark. Zorn's also designed compositions as games for improvisers to play. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead generally likes the surprises Zorn has in store, but he says Zorn's new album is weird, even by Zorn standards.
John Zorn's new album, Spy vs. Spy, is one of the most perplexing records I've heard in a while. It's almost like he wants you not to like it. For instance, most albums are laid out to highlight their variety. You know, slow numbers intercut with fast ones. But Spy vs. Spy begins with about 10 songs that sound like this. Zorn's inspiration on Spy vs. Spy is the post-punk rock music known as hardcore. One note on the sleeve says, "Hardcore rules." Another one tells you to crank up the volume. The tracks are fast, relentless, short, redundant, and monochromatic, just like hardcore. Zorn's twist is to play them on acoustic instruments. He and Tim Byrne play alto sax, Michael Vacher and Joey Barron slug it out on drums, and Mark Dresser is caught in the middle on bass. But the sound quality is so flattened out, the music sounds like a bus accident. Like episodes of the Mad Magazine comic strip called Spy vs. Spy, these tunes are quickies, minimally plotted and all done in the same style. There's one other bit of perversity here. All 17 tracks on the album were written and previously recorded by jazz composer and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. To really appreciate what Zorn has done to the material, first listen to how Ornette played his tune Blues Connotation in 1960. Coleman, typically, stays lyrical even when he squawks. Now listen to John Zorn's version of Blues Connotation. Don't worry, it's short. I think it's fair to say the lyricism of the original is missing there. To give Zorn his due, he is bringing to jazz a kind of bracing energy that hasn't been heard since the heyday of free jazz over 20 years ago. Ornette Coleman was a prime mover in that movement, but his music has always been distinguished by its congeniality. Zorn's manic takes don't really do justice to his musicians either. You wouldn't know from listening to drummer Joey Barron here that he's a master of delicate textures. I mentioned earlier that Spy vs. Spy is front-loaded with its most ferocious material. Tucked away at the end of the program are a few relatively calm performances in which Zorn's quintet plays Coleman's music more on its own terms. Just remind us that they're playing it hardcore because they want to, not because they have to. Zorn and Tim Byrne approach the emotional cry of Coleman's own saxophone playing on Broadway Blues. really weird thing about Spy vs. Spy is, after living with it a little, it starts to grow on you, no matter how hard it tries to be obnoxious. It's kind of like when you see a little kid trying to throw a tantrum, and you say, isn't that adorable?
The album is Spy vs. Spy. This is Fresh Air. Some of the more unconventional newcomers to the world of hard-boiled fiction are lesbian feminist detectives. Critic B. Ruby Rich writes, if there's any one book that perfectly balances literary, feminist, and detective demands, that's sexy and witty and has the best title to boot, it's Mary Wing's tale, She Came Too Late. There's a new Mary Wings novel that just came out called She Came in a Flash. The heroine of both books is Emma Victor, a radical feminist turned amateur detective. The new mystery involves a women's benefit concert that gets a dubious donation from the Women's Freedom Foundation, which turns out to be affiliated with a New Age cult group. Here's Mary Wings reading an excerpt from She Came in a Flash.
I sat a moment looking at the valley. I thought about a gay man I knew who worked for what used to be Ma Bell Phone Company. He might help me with the phone number of the Women's Freedom Foundation. I went into the beautiful California weather and shut myself in the sheet metal box where I spent most of my Californian life, a beige 1973 Plymouth Satellite custom sedan. I put the key in the ignition and the engine slowly turned over. Maya appeared from a barn hauling a sack of organic starter feed. Thanks for checking out this Women's Freedom Foundation thing, Emma, she blew me a kiss. I'm not doing it for you, I said. I know, you have a true revolutionary soul, Emma. I let that one go. We both knew about my revolutionary soul. It had been relativized away. What was left over was an inclination to work on projects that went in the right direction. And if a few thrills came with the territory, that was okay, too. It was time to clean up a few loose ends, fetus fanatics and the verbal agreements of rock stars. I didn't know then what a dirty job it would be.
Mary, is detective fiction a vehicle for you to express a certain cynicism with the all-embracing sisterhood of 1960s feminism and the duty to be constantly affirming?
I think that there is a kind of feminist pedestal combined with a sort of Californian, let's have a nice day culture, everyone being really friendly to each other and not disagreeing too much. And there's an underside to that that I definitely wanted to uncover.
Your main character, she used to be more of an activist, and you know, as she describes in the reading that you just read, she's changed. Has there been a change in you over the years in terms of how you see yourself within the women's movement?
Sure, there has been a change in me. For one thing, I think the difference between what was happening in the late 60s and early 70s and all that incredible sense of idealism, I know that I and my friends really thought that we were remaking the world, and one of our sort of illusions was that we were going to have new relationships that were going to be completely different than anything that went before.
Right, especially because there were lesbian relationships. You could really like start from scratch culturally in mainstream America.
Exactly.
Why did you start writing detective fiction?
I started writing detective fiction for a couple different reasons, but I think the main initial sort of motivation was that I was living in a non-English-speaking country. I was going to dinner parties that lasted for 5 hours where I didn't understand a word of what anyone was saying. And I had this feeling like, hey, you guys, I can make conversation too. I can tell jokes and anecdotes, but there was no real arena for me because the most I could express was things like, I go store now. So I would go back to my room, and it was sort of like playing with your Barbie and Ken dolls. I would just sit there with my fantasies, and I would create my own dinner party and my own dialogue. And as I had visitors from America, I became really enamored again from a sort of new perspective of American English, because it is so playful and open and colorful and malleable. People are willing to say just about anything in American English, and I like that so much. So those sorts of memories and that kind of isolation really spurred me to create my own world on paper.
One of the reasons why I read a lot of detective fiction is because it's filled with interesting observations, because the detective is always walking around narrating about what they're observing. And your novels are filled with interesting observations about women and the women's movement and you know, the lesbian feminist community. For instance, in your first novel, Emma Victor, the amateur detective, has to get dressed up sometimes to go to, oh, say, a party where a mysterious funder is going to be, who she's investigating. And in order to get into this party, she has to dress up in women's formal wear, and that means shaving her legs, putting on stockings, wearing high heels, putting on an ironed formal dress. And she thinks of herself as dressing in drag, and she starts, like, walking in a different way. And I thought that was very funny. And I think you don't have to be a lesbian to relate to that, to feeling like you're putting on drag when you have to dress up in certain women's clothes.
Yeah, there's so many situations in life, especially for women, I think, where we're judged so much by our appearances and all these sort of little attributes that we have. I think accessories is the word, in fact, that we're often in one kind of drag or another.
In your new book, Emma has moved from Boston to San Francisco. Why did you have her relocate?
She needed the sun. She was getting really pale. And I'm more familiar with California myself, and also I could use my own feelings in moving back to California to bring into the book that sense of tension and my own observations as I was sort of repatriating here.
The novel set in San Francisco, and the plot revolves around this mysterious, possibly dangerous, New Age cult group called the Divine Vishnu Inspiration Commune.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of what you're doing here is trying to understand the attraction of a group for women where the women can come and kind of dress like princesses,
mm-hmm.
and where women are equated with intuition and receptivity and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what fascinates me is the contradictions. It's obviously really easy to make fun of a group like that, but on the other hand, I really wanted in some way to feel attracted to it myself. And, you know, a place where life is really sort of solved in a situation like that. And to that end, I actually went sort of undercover into a cult group in Amsterdam. I had a lot of friends there who were aware of that group, and a lot of people were bicycling around the canals wearing all red clothing. So that's what I did. I signed myself up for a weekend intensive.
What was it like?
First of all, I felt like I had to get my costume together, and most of my friends had purged all the red clothing out of their wardrobes because they never wanted to be remotely associated with this group. So I, in fact, was borrowing red clothes from friends that were from the middle 60s. So I had these bell-bottom trousers. Everything was in pink and red socks and red tennis shoes, even down to red underwear. And I signed up for this weekend intensive, and it was very scary. It was a lot what a lot of other people say about these kinds of things. They don't leave you alone for a minute. You're constantly being given instructions, given exercises, herded around, herded even to the bathroom and back, constantly with a group. And there was a real emphasis placed on constantly emoting in these workshops. And people were doing things, they were just kind of going off the deep end is what it looked like to me. And it was a pretty scary experience, actually. I left after the first night. I wasn't able to complete the whole thing. And I didn't feel really good about it. I don't think I would make a good undercover reporter. I felt dishonest about it. I felt like too much of a voyeur, really, in that situation.
Have you ever been in a dangerous situation? Have you ever gotten yourself into serious trouble like your character does?
No, I've been fairly lucky in my life not to have been in a dangerous situation, but I'm aware that it happens all the time. And I think that is something that perhaps makes these books attractive to women, is that we live with all this sort of unspoken danger. I live in a house where it would be, which is on the ground floor, and it'd be really easy for someone to climb in the window. And in fact, I did find someone peeking in the window a few years ago. And it reminds me that we are always in this, we are living with a sense of danger and very real danger all the time, even if nothing happens to us. So that sort of hidden, covert feeling that's there all the time may be worked out in a book like this.
There's love scenes in your novel, sex scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've taught erotic fiction.
Mm-hmm.
When you first started writing, did you find that hard to do?
It was very interesting writing about sex. What I realized was that I kind of wanted to play with all the genre conventions, so I knew there should be a lot of suspense, and there should be some violence, and there should be some drugs and drinking in there in some way or another, and that there should also be sex. And at what point was I going to pull the shade down and you were only going to see the silhouettes at the end of the chapter? And I thought, I want to go a little farther and just see what it's like to write about it. My first feeling right away, I remember blushing as I was writing this stuff, and I thought, everyone's going to know what I do. Since then, as I've read sex scenes that other authors have written, I realize I never think that about them. The initial feeling when you're writing this stuff is that you're just revealing yourself completely.
What detective fiction did you read and like before you started writing?
I didn't like very much of it, actually. I liked some of the early 40s hard-boiled things like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. I didn't like so much the Poison Tea and the Vicar's Garden kind of Agatha Christie sorts of things. I liked the things that had suspense, and I liked the sort of more noirish kinds of novels.
Are there things you didn't like about the hard-boiled fiction that you read that you wanted to do differently?
There was an incredible amount of drinking. I mean, when I started counting the drinks, I wondered how they could even get their way sort of through them. And also, it was too hard for me. A sort of anti-hero still needs to be fairly vulnerable, and some of those heroes certainly weren't.
Okay. Mary Wings, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mary Wings' new novel, She Came in a Flash, is published by New American Library. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing from Spencer Sherman about events in Beijing just about 100 days after the massacre in Tiananmen Square. Also, a talk with a Hungarian foreign ministry official about that country's policy of letting East Germans out into Austria, which has created such a remarkable situation in Central Europe. And we'll be talking with Jefferson Morley, who wrote an article in the New Republic. He's the editor of The Nation magazine, about his use of crack and what it was actually like the night that he smoked several rocks of crack. And James Dickey, our obituary for Robert Penwarren, who died today.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Al Pacino is back on the big screen as a cop in the new movie Sea of Love. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Sea of Love is an ordinary cop story with extraordinary texture. And the texture doesn't come from the look of the film or the direction by Harold Becker. It comes from the characters and the dialogue that Richard Price, the screenwriter, has given them. His writing isn't flamboyant or lyrical. It achieves a combination of hard-bitten grit and loopy emotion, a kind of New York street romanticism that's absolutely intoxicating. The plot is simple. Al Pacino plays a boozy, lonely cop on the trail of a killer whose victims are guys who place personal ads in a New York weekly. The murderer especially goes for the ones who resort to forlorn love poetry. Pacino and his partner, played by the wonderful John Goodman of Roseanne fame, decide to place an ad of their own. Then they meet the respondents in a restaurant, offer them a glass of wine, and later take fingerprints off the wine glasses. All of which works until a sexy shoe store clerk, played by Ellen Barkin, comes in and refuses even a sip of Chardonnay.
You like the park and I like the beach. You like movies, I like plays. You're a printer, I manage a shoe store. And I don't believe in wasting time on this kind of stuff. You know what you know, and you go with it.
You go with what?
You're just not my type.
Just sat down. Give a little bit of time.
I believe in animal attraction. I believe in love at first sight. I believe in this. And I don't feel it with you.
Well, I'm hell on wheels once you get to know me, honey.
It's nothing personal.
Oh, come on. Where are you going?
After a beginning like that, of course, movie logic dictates that love must follow. But Pacino never does manage to get Barkin's fingerprints. And the film spends the rest of its length deftly flipping back and forth between she's the killer and how can you say such a thing? What makes that flip-flopping so resonant is the undercurrent of loneliness and need in the characters. Sea of Love depicts New York as a city of violence, longing, and solitude, a place where love and paranoia are constantly at war, and where people desperately need to be sure of one another, and can't be, ever. Barkin gives a star-making performance as the kind of brittle, independent, yet needy woman who has to be secretive, either because women like her are always in danger of being judged or consumed, or else because she has something darker to hide. And Pacino? Well, it's been 4 years since he showed up in a movie, and frankly, he hasn't been terribly missed. His last picture, Revolution, was hilariously bad, and before that he'd made several films in a row, each one an argument against our need for him. Movies like Scarface, Author, and Cruising. Pacino had gone off the beam somehow. An actor needs to have a kind of inner gyroscope, a mechanism that tells him where truth and verisimilitude lie and warns him when he's veering off into empty mannerism. Pacino had lost that gyroscope. His acting had become hollow, showy, and cold. But in Sea of Love, he's terrific. His voice has a new, gruff, lived-in quality. His body is thick and his face jowly and ravaged, and his liquid eyes, which used to be such a come-on, now look like pools of woe. Maybe he's a little less vibrant than he used to be, but he's never been so touching. He needs a break, and so does the cop he plays. And his lonesomeness is so palpable that no one can doubt the way he drops his professional guard to let romance in. Sea of Love doesn't quite push the envelope the way it might have. At times, its sizzle promises more steak than it delivers. But what a sizzle. Even after you've left the theater, it keeps ringing in your ears.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Ed Dougherty, and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries. It's all edited and mixed by Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director and screenwriter Paul Schrader talks about his work on the films Taxi Driver and The Last Temptation of Christ. Also, TV critic David Bianculli looks at some new fall comedies. And Milo Miles introduces us to Algerian rhyme music. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.